Hello. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Bill.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing swimmingly, and you?
I'm doing well. You had an interesting morning on the old TV tube.
I had an interesting morning today and yesterday, Bill. Yesterday, I wake up, and I've not had my requisite cup or cups of Starbucks coffee, and I see that Joe Scarborough is not on Morning Joe, which I watch every day, as you know.
You watch MSNBC just start to finish all day long?
Not to finish, but to start. So I'm watching it, and Joe Scarborough's not there, and at one point Willie Geist isn't there either, and it's basically like Mika Brzezinski and Donnie Deutsch and Chris Matthews and Tina Brown and Christina Vandenhuvel or whatever from The Nation. I mean,
so it sounds like a communist takeover.
You said that, not me, but I have to tell you, it did remind me of the Pauline Kael line that's at least attributed to her about how she didn't know anyone who voted for Nixon. It wasn't just liberally biased, but it was actually painful to watch. And so, you know, I did something which is really stupid. I started tweeting, criticizing it.
And Twitter is there for people to make mistakes.
Yes.
And embarrass themselves.
So I stupidly tweeted a bunch of things, keeping in mind, of course, that I'm not a regular on the show, but I've been on the show several times and like the show, and I'm a fan and would like to go back on. But I start tweeting, you know, presumably, but I start tweeting things like lots of balance this morning on Mojo. You have the left and the far left and stuff like that. And to my surprise, they started reading my tweets on the air. And they were actually agreeing, like conceding a lot of the things.
So were you hashtagging it or
no?
How do you think they caught the tweet?
I think that Willie Geist follows me and happened to see it. And by the way,
basically, someone on the show was actually watching a Twitter stream while the show was going on.
It could have been. You know what? I will say this: on one of the tweets, I said @morning_Joe, but the rest of them. I was just, you know, saying watching Mojo, which is my abbreviation for the show. I don't even know if anyone else. So anyway, instead of being like pissed off at me and banning me from their show, which is what most people would do, they invited me on. So I was actually on Morning Joe this morning.
Are we talking about why yesterday sucked? Or are we talking about something else?
Something else. We were talking about Newt Gingrich and how I think it's not that big of a deal that he was paid money by Freddie Mac. And so it was a bit contentious, but it wasn't like a setup. It wasn't like they had me on to go after me. It was just a normal interview. And by the way, I think the audience was better served by having me on sort of making the conservative case, or at least the case for Newt. So I think it's a win-win. I think today was a
So are you suggesting that the way people can get themselves on the air these days is by blatantly maligning the shows that they want to be on?
I would say that is a high-risk strategy, and one that I would not
recommend. So sure, actually. I would not be surprised if you go back and find other examples where someone is actively complaining about something and then the show booker decides, you know what, let's keep this conversation going and draw attention to our show by having the critics on.
I think it's a great idea, and I think they're smart for doing it. I do wonder if this is a turning point for Twitter. I mean, if nothing else, it proves that it was driving the discussion.
I mean, it's got to be hard for a show. I mean, Morning Joe may be a particularly loose show in the annals of cable TV, but there are certain shows such as the old Rick Sanchez show on CNN where having a Twitter stream and talking to the viewers was sort of a staple of the show.
Right.
But it's something else to say we're going to have someone on the staff keep an eye out on Twitter, see what they're saying about the show, so we can talk about it as the show is going on.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of shows do that.
It's a great idea, but it's not something I've seen them do before necessarily. I mean, maybe they have.
Right.
They
must be doing it at least informally
to keep
tabs on what's being said.
Informally, definitely. And I mean, they didn't have any like graphics for this. I mean, Willie was reading it like off of his iPhone or BlackBerry or whatever on the air. So I mean, it wasn't like this was a shtick. But anyway, kudos to them for welcoming the critics and for encouraging dissent and not banishing me.
Hey, Matt, let's go. So you were on talking about Newt, and I think Newt is probably the biggest political story of the week. From my liberal perspective, somewhat inexplicably, I mean, we've seen candidates, you know, fall and rise before. So just the fact that someone was down before and is now back up is not terribly unusual. But Newt seemed to be just massively humiliated, and he was humiliated in the spring and summer of his campaign. Two, he's not a new face like a Herman Cain. Or new to the national scene, like a Rick Perry. Newt's baggage has been well established and often maligned by other conservatives. So, can you explain? Is there anything in the conservative blogosphere that could inform folks outside of that world? Why is Newt being given an 102nd look and being taken seriously as a possible presidential nominee at this point?
Look, I just think it's shockingly clear that you fundamentally don't grasp Newt Gingrich. He's been at this since 1974. He has founded the Center for Health Transformation as he was Speaker. And I think it's just shocking that that you fundamentally fail to understand him.
I think I do understand him.
Look, no rational person...
I don't respect him.
No rational
I think
person
I understand
could
him.
Possibly believe that Newt is anything other than brilliant. I wrote a piece a while ago called How to Talk Like Newt in 7 Easy Steps, and I've just used about 4 or 5 of the steps.
Oh, I see. I see. You were doing a little jiu-jitsu on me.
Yeah. You start off with look, and there's a whole thing here. Shockingly, stunningly. Newt's got a lot of baggage. My point was, and you're right. I mean, I think we talked about this, or maybe you weren't here last week when I talked about it, but Michelle Malkin has attacked Newt. A lot of people, a lot of conservatives, a lot of conservative writers and bloggers have gone after Newt for a variety of things. You know, he was in a TV ad with Nancy Pelosi, and I think Al Sharpton, and he supported Didi Scozzafava, the liberal Republican, which he now says is really one of the stupidest things he's done. He's got a ton of baggage, and so I don't necessarily think that he will win the nomination, but he's very...
I guess there seems to be a sense out there. I mean, all the things you just mentioned, conservative bloggers... I guess know about that stuff, and conservative Washington folks know about that stuff. Do you think conservative rank and file know about the Pelosi ad and the Didi Scozzafava? Is that what really is tattooed in their brain? And two, even if they do know that, it seems like people are buying the notion. It seems almost an after effect of the Rick Perry flame out that people are saying you have to be a good debater to be a presidential nominee, and Newt is brilliant, and he's good at debating, and that's what we need to go toe-to-toe with Obama in 2012. I would challenge almost all of those premises, but it seems like that's what the current thinking is for the moment. Is that fair?
I think it's an interesting and plausible theory. I agree with you debating for whatever reason has really been a big deal. I wonder if voters, even the people who are they're polling, are that strategic in their thinking to say, beating Obama is the most important thing, therefore we need someone who can beat Obama, therefore we need someone who can debate well therefore we want new. I just really question whether or not average voters are that strategic.
Well, then what is it? I mean, obviously, the guy is doing nothing else in his campaign but debate. He's got no discernible campaign staff or advertising budget or anything. All he's done is the debates.
No, I mean, that, I think Newt's been in the early states. I mean, I get emails all the time that he's going to be at some dinner in some place in Iowa or New. I mean, he has been campaigning hard in, and I know early on he did that, he like went on vacation to Greece or whatever. But he has been hitting Iowa at least pretty darn hard lately. But look, you're right. I don't think it's strategic. Like, we need Newt because he'll be a great debater against Obama. I mean, pundits say that, but for the average person, I just think it's Newt's a good debater. I like him in debates, so that's why I'll support. I just don't think it's quite the strategic thing of electability being a factor.
Uh-huh. But that's you don't think electability is dominating the thinking of the average base voter or the average conservative blogger?
I don't think so. I mean, I know this is a popular theory that's bandied about a lot lately, but I just think it's who do you like? And so I think that Newt's debating makes people like him, and it's that simple, as opposed to this, like, convoluted theory of electability and, you know, who's going to be the best debater against Obama. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that's just my take.
Now, I know you've written in the past various criteria you think need to be met for a candidate to go all the way in the primary.
I gave up on that after I declared that Tim Pawlenty would be that. met all of my conditions. But look, I still say that if Pawlenty hadn't dropped out and hadn't put all of his eggs in the Ames, Iowa straw poll basket, he still might be viable.
What I think is you shouldn't flagellate yourself over this, because I find that this particular race, and there are a lot of races where people say that the candidates look lame and they can't go toe-to-toe with an incumbent, and that's because everyone's going to look kind of small relative to an incumbent at this stage of the process, so I don't want to overplay that argument. But it does feel like this particular crop of candidates is uniquely unqualified.
See, I want to challenge that, Bill. I want to challenge. I wrote about this yesterday at the Daily Caller because.
But just before you get to that, it's not just in their resumes, but in their campaigns. That there are several campaigns that just are not doing what would normally be the bare minimum you do to win, and therefore it's hard to assess them on a normal grading curve because they're all kind of horrible. So, but someone has to be the least horrible at the end of the day.
So I wrote about this yesterday at the Daily Caller, my Center for Health Transformation and 21st Century Reclaiming America. And it was called I titled it, Will Primary Gaffes Hurt the GOP Brand? And I premised it essentially off of a Newsweek piece that Paul Vigala wrote, where he basically, says, how do we devolve to the point where the leading Republican candidate for president can't count to three? And he sort of later made this transition into sort of arguing that this is a sign that conservatism, which was once an intellectual movement, is now devoid of ideas. And, I sort of reject that. I mean, I think a couple things are at play, including the fact that we have this 24-hour cable TV / blog-driven / Twitter-driven world. And as I wrote, I mean, what Howard Dean, that I have a scream speech being played on a reel over and over and over again. I mean, the other side has gaffes too. And I mean, like, it's not like Al Sharpton and Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel would have been like stellar candidates. And at the end of the day, the Democrats in the last two cycles ended up nominating fairly competent people, John Kerry, and fairly competent and fairly serious people, despite the fact that, Obama did say there were 57 states at some point and, made that unfortunate joke about the Special Olympics. By and large, these were competent, serious people. So I just think it's like a mistake to, number one, judge Republicans by what if Gary Bauer and Pat Robertson existed in this media cycle. We would be saying, oh my gosh, the Republican Party isn't serious. The guy fell off the stage. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Chris Matthews would be playing that over and over again. And you might say, well, Republicans have no hope of winning. And of course, I think
that was 96, right? I mean, in that race, you know, you had Bob Dole, the Senate, you know, minority leader. And I'm trying to remember. I mean, Steve Forbes was sort of and Pat
Forbes
Buchanan.
Ran a few
were,
times.
I mean, more kind of atypical, non-traditional candidates, which is why Bob Dole, you know, had a fairly.
Well, Pat Buchanan ran. I'm sorry, I meant Pat Robertson. If I said Pat Buchanan, but Pat Robertson ran in '88 when Bush
right.
when Bush did win, and I think
right.
And I think Gary Bauer ran in 2000. But my point being, simply that that these look campaigns, and I actually go into economics in this. Schumpeter's creative destruction. I think that conservatives, by and large, in terms of economics, believe that you have this competition of ideas, and when progress happens, some companies go out of business. And it's not a failure that some companies fail. It's actually good, as opposed to central planning, which, by the way, in July, central planning might have said, okay, guys, let's make Rick Perry the nominee. You know, he's got the right look. He's from a big state.
Or Tim Pawlenty.
Right. Like, if they'd listened to me, right?
Right.
That would have been really
if you were the central planner, we'd all be lost.
We'd be lost because this competition's good. And, yes, it's ugly. And you might have said, well, we'll save Tim Pawlenty from having to endure a rough primary. It could be embarrassing. He could get beat up. Let's save our money. I mean, you could have said all that, but the truth is that, like, these contests are good, and Barack Obama was a better candidate because of the challenge Hillary Clinton presented him.
I agree with everything you said.
So the hand-wringing is what I think is overwrought, is my point.
I agree with all you said there, but on the hand-wringing point, I do think it's a little bit different. I mean, it's not unusual to have a certain portion of your candidates essentially not be serious candidates. Democrats have non-serious candidates. Republicans have non-serious candidates. That's not unusual. But what seems to be more unusual here is you have a lot of candidates, in particular Gingrich, Kaine, Santorum, Bachman, which have, you know, almost no discernible serious campaign infrastructure at all. And two of those, Kaine and Gingrich, have had, you know, serious turns in the spotlight as actually being at the top of the pack, maybe not, we don't know for Gingrich, but for Kaine for some relatively sustained period of time of several days. And the people who have sort of more campaign infrastructure, Romney and Perry, Perry is being taken less and less seriously because of his debate performances, and Romney seems to have a resistance because even as the most establishment figure, his policy positions are anathema to a lot of voters. Whereas in the other races you mentioned, 88, you know, Pat Robinson had a decent run, but he was up against a sitting vice president. And in 1996, you know, Buchanan and Forbes had their moments, but Bob Dole was a Senate minority leader. He had broader base of support going in. Romney is not at that level. So the general weakness of the establishment candidate seems to be making what would otherwise have candidates get run out of town by regular competitive free market structure a lot faster. They seem to be hanging around a lot longer when it doesn't seem, and that makes it very hard to gauge where it all ends up, I think.
No, I do think the world is changing and has changed. And, you know, I mean, Tim Pawlenty had all the bells and whistles of county chairman and consultants and all the traditional stuff, and it didn't help him. And it is interesting that there does seem to be an inverse relationship between being like running a competent traditional campaign and being interesting and exciting. It almost seems like.
I mean, so do you think it's possible, if the rules are changing, that a Herman Kaine or a Newt Gingrich could actually win an Iowa caucus on January 3rd in the dead of winter and get people to show up and stand in a room for 3 hours and vote for them without having traditional campaign infrastructure?
I'm skeptical, but I think it's possible. And I think that the Republicans aren't the difficulty in caucusing for Republicans, I don't think, is as Byzantine as it is for Democrats. I'm not an expert on Iowa. But I do think it's possible that the zeitgeist and the media attention could prop up a candidate. But I'm a little skeptical. I mean, I'd like to see it before I believe it. I mean, it stands to reason if it snows, the people that have a traditional turnout mechanism will perform better than the people who just have TV and exciting speeches. So, but I don't rule it out until it happens. I'd rather have both. If I were running for office, I would want both. I would want to be exciting and on TV and sort of running a media campaign, and I would also want to actually have a ground game. That seems to me like the smart move if you have the opportunity. So, but I don't discount the fact that the rules are changing, and even if it doesn't work in Iowa, it may work in New Hampshire. So,
now, we've talked before about, and not just you and me, but I'm sure other folks talk about YouTube moments being very defining on the campaign trail, but I believe it was Think Progress that first put on YouTube Newt Gingrich's flip-flopping on Libya back in March, and this was a devastating moment in his campaign that sort of took apart this notion that he was a true elder statesman when he was saying opposite views about Libya within a week based on what was perceived to be the anti-Obama position of that moment, and he had a very difficult time explaining himself. But that seems to be totally forgotten now in this new boomlet. No one is worrying, you know, regardless of what you disagree with Gingrich policy-wise, people seem to be back to thinking he is a brilliant elder statesman and not thinking about the times when he's really put his foot in his mouth.
Yeah.
So is there a shelf life on the YouTube moment, I guess, is my question.
No, I think that all that stuff could come back. I mean, especially the picture of Gingrich on a couch with Nancy Pelosi. Once something's in video or in pictures, it can always come back. And it will. I mean, look, there I'm employing a newtism. Look, frankly. The reason that this hasn't come, the reason Newt was able to come back was because no one thought he was a danger. So they were busy attacking Rick Perry and Herman Cain and leaking oppo on them. And as soon as Newt became a serious contender, this Fannie or Freddie Mac stuff came out. And I suspect that if Newt continues to lead in polls, you're going to see videos come back to haunt him and some things will be recycled. And so anything that's on picture that's captured in a picture or on a video is especially damaging. And you'll see, if Newt's a serious contender, if he continues to be, you'll see web ads and even TV ads featuring Newt saying one thing and then the other. And by the way, I caught him out on the no-fly zone thing, as you may recall, because it was pretty blatant. What it is. I just think it's a factor of you don't attack somebody unless they're a threat, and until recently, Gingrich has not been a threat.
Now, speaking of the Freddie Mac story, and that was an example of what seems to be some old school investigative reporting by Bloomberg, finding out that there are Freddie Mac officials who give an opposite story of what Newt Gingrich was paid to do for Freddie Mac. Gingrich says he was paid to be an historian and told them that what you're doing is creating a housing bubble back in 2006. I put up a post today, just a self-promotion note. If that's true, I wonder why you didn't tell anybody else in 2006 that this bubble was coming. It might have been useful information for people to consider. But I bring up this whole notion of investigative reporting because this is sort of something that was ferreted out by Bloomberg. We haven't seen a whole lot of investigative reporting in this cycle so far. It's mostly been about debate performances, with the possible exception of the Herman Cain sexual harassment allegations. And I don't know if it's investigative reporting, just someone going to the press. You flagged a post by Ben Dominich. Did I pronounce it correctly?
I think it's Dominich.
Dominich.
I've known the guy for 10 years, and I'm not sure. But I think
lamenting
it's
that the conservative blogosphere and the conservative media world is not putting a lot of investment in it, in real reporting.
Yeah.
And it seems to be leaning on, as a crutch, mere pontificating as a reason of being, and therefore they're missing out on opportunities. Is this a notion that is stirring up some discussion on the conservative side of things?
Yeah, I actually sent it around to a bunch of my colleagues here at the Daily Caller because I think, number one, it's a feather in our cap that the Daily Caller is one of the few sites on in the center-right journalism world that does real reporting and breaks news, but also as a reminder that we all need to be breaking news and reporting, not just writing or not just sort of latching onto other people's stories but sort of changing or setting the debate, leading the discussion, winning the morning, as Politico says. But so Ben Domenech's his post is actually a common lament, but it's so well written and he did such a good job of it. I wanted to highlight it. He says the general trend among conservatives is to ditch the investigative reporting thing and move into what we might call Novak Light reporting, or Novak Light opinion writing. They talk to sources and cover events, but rarely break news. He goes on to say it's not debatable. It's no longer debatable. Andrew Breitbart has done more for the cause of conservative investigative coverage than any of the right-leaning outlets under Obama, meaning during the Obama administration. And that's something the D.C. New York conservative professional thumbsuckers should be ashamed of. And then lastly, he goes on to explain why this is the case. It's obviously just easier to write opinion than to break news. But he says most of the money on the right, which would otherwise go to people with the dedication and skill to tease out stories, ends up instead in the slower moving legacy organizations, which are always late to the party. And I think he's dead right on that. But what's your take, Bill? Number one, is he right? Number two, is this a problem that the left has too, or is this something specific to right-leaning journalist outlets?
Well, maybe. I mean, I think I'm sure the ratio of pontificators to investigators is still heavily skewed in the favor of pontificators because opinion is inherently cheap. So,
right.
There's always going to be a dominance of that,
not
no matter what
cheap,
you do,
and not just cheap monetarily, although that's a prime factor. I mean, going to paying someone to be a reporter who lives in New Hampshire, who basically moves to New Hampshire or travels with the campaign with a camera, is a lot more expensive than having someone sit in an office reading tweets or blogging or whatever. But
right.
It's also even a time commitment. Like, I can tell you, because my blog is a bit unique, it's kind of a nexus, like a hybrid of journalism, analysis, and reporting. So I do all three, but the reporting stuff takes 10 times as long to
right.
do because the messy business of actually getting things right and calling people, and then
right.
you know it's
and there's a primacy in the online media world for speed, and if you're spending a lot of time reporting on something, you do it without the assurance you're going to get something.
Right.
You might spend a lot of time on something that doesn't even pan out, whereas if you popped off about something and you were first to pop off, that might actually get you a traffic spike.
Great point. You will spend hours of time and end up spiking a story because it just didn't go where you thought it was going to go, or someone beat you to the punch or whatever.
Right.
It's just it's a time, a cost-benefit analysis. And also,
but I do think on the left you have institutions, you know, The Nation magazine, for example, has always had an investigative fund, and they still produce stuff from time to time that captures a lot of attention. Huffington Post has long experimented with investigative journalism, and I believe they still partner with ProPublica. All the places that ProPublica partners with, I get lost in remembering where they're currently at. But ProPublica is a whole nonprofit operation that's dedicated to investigative journalism, and they partner with a lot of traditional media outlets, as well as Huffington Post. So there's always been an interest in liberal media infrastructure to fund that sort of thing. And one of the reasons why, you know, Huffington Post has done as well as it has, I mean, part of it is just sort of cheap link bait, but part of it is that they do bring you a scoop from time to time, and that gives you a reason to keep checking back. So it certainly behooves, I think, either ideological camp to put some emphasis in ferreting out information that might not otherwise get ferreted out. But you run the risk, of course, in if you put your ideological blinders on, that you might ferret out something that turns out not to be true. And, you know, Domenech is highlighting Andrew Breitbart as sort of a shiny example of conservative journalism when he has had his missteps, to say the least, which have a serious problem with credibility, and perhaps in a more idealistic world would have banished him from media respectability at this point, and maybe it hasn't, which is an argument to say it doesn't matter if you get it right or wrong, because as long as you're stirring up trouble, that's good enough. But I do think at the end of the day, you know, his scoops, you know, people might pause a little bit more the next time he does one because it doesn't always hit the target.
Well, I want to sort of go back to the main, without getting into a debate about him, where we probably disagree. Go back to the main premise, which I think is really interesting, which is just the cheapness of opinion, in terms of, like, when I was at townhall.com, for example, I wanted to do like an off the bus thing, like the Huffington Post did, because Town Hall had this community of, we called them user bloggers, people who like started a blog that was hosted at townhall.com, and they got a place to post their blogs and had the Town Hall logo. We got to serve ads on their site where they would ostensibly drive traffic to. And the idea was to like get, you know, a certain number of them who are really good and credible and competent, and to have pay one person to manage them and to basically say, hey, you're in Nevada, Mitt Romney's coming there, will you go to this event? Instead, we decided to build radio station websites for, because it's owned by a radio station company. So we spent like countless hours and many, 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 many dollars doing that instead. And what Town Hall's business model essentially was, they do, you know, when I was there, it was me and Amanda Carpenter and Mary Catherine Hamm, and of course Hugh Hewitt's part of that family. So we were doing some reporting. Now they've got some good people too, but still, you know, they've got some good Katie Pavlich and Guy Benson, just to name a couple, some good writers and reporters. But still, their bread and butter is, you know, hey, why pay somebody when we can put up an Ann Coulter column or a George Will column for 25 cents or something ridiculous, syndicated, like for every million people who view it? I don't even know. It's you know, I didn't know that business side of it, on the editorial side. But I mean, the bottom line is it's much cheaper than hiring a staffer that you have to pay health care for or
right,
parking space for in Roslyn. And that's why, you know, not to toot our horn, but I think it is pretty awesome at the Daily Caller. And by the way, I don't want to get into this too much, but there was I think her name's Keech Hagee at Politico, wrote a piece about the Daily Caller, which a lot of people thought was going to be very critical, and it largely was. But the one thing that I thought was terrific was the acknowledgement that we do real reporting and break original news here, and so, you know, kudos to us.
Well, and I mean, there's two business models here. I mean, I'm sure there's a cheap business model that works where you just get a bunch of content that someone else does, and you get it for not a lot of money, and you sell ads, and people, and as long as you become a, you know, I mean, Drudge Report essentially, you know, Drudge obviously has his gossipy stuff from time to time, but you know, 99% of the time it's just link aggregation.
Yeah.
And if you do it in sort of a clean enough way, and run ads based on that by attracting the eyeballs.
Yeah, and at the micro level, that makes sense. But the problem, I think, and Domenech doesn't really get into this, but at the macro level, the problem is everybody who reports news has some bias, whether it's cultural or whatever. And if the only people doing original reporting are people who are liberal-leaning, then at some level, all news reporting shifts to being liberal-leaning. And so,
without accepting the premise that most traditional reporting is liberal-leaning, I agree that there is certainly room for real reporting through an ideological lens, as long as it's transparent, everyone understands where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I thought Mother Jones, for example, you know, Mother Jones is doing, you know, liberal investigative journalism for a very long time. And, you know, they have gradually, I think, adapted pretty well to an online format and gotten their stuff to resonate more than perhaps it had when it was just solely a print publication. And some of their Occupy Wall Street reporting, you know, has been really good reporting. I mean, I have a much better understanding of the origins of the protest.
I read some of that stuff, and I find some of it really good. And Mother Jones and other, like the New Republic, which is, I guess, a left-leaning site, Rolling Stone. I mean, some of these sites, which some, you know, some of their like opinion stuff would scare me. Some of the reporting that they do is really good. And
so I think from Mother Jones's perspective, you know, they have an ideological interest for the Occupy movement to be taken seriously and be a big thing. So I'm sure there's a part of it that is we're making an editorial judgment to treat it like a big thing so more people do. But if they were just being cheerleaders and that's it, I don't think it would get as much attention as it is if we have produced a story about how the movement actually came to be that no one else has. Everyone has sort of lazily assumed it came from Adbusters magazine because they ran the first, you know, advertisement about it, when actually there's a deeper story how it came about that no one else has.
Yeah.
I think that's value that even an ideological outfit can do if they put the emphasis into shoe leather reporting.
Oh, my God, it's over for Demi and Ashton, according to the Washington Post. If those two kids
that's breaking news.
If those two kids can't make it, I don't know how
all is lost.
So what was I going to say?
I don't know. Oh. My world has been rocked. I'm not sure anyone can remember chains of thought.
I think you are right in that if they write good stuff, then that's credible. Then even I read it and take that seriously, and that's much better than them being overtly biased. I do think that. And I use the word insidious, which probably has a negative connotation, but I think that if you want to influence the debate, it's not by biased reporting. How do I put this? Some of the most insidious bias is not overt bias, because then it wouldn't be insidious. It is rather choosing what stories to cover and what stories to ignore. And I think that's the caveat to that is that it's important to have, say, center-right and center-left journalists, because the mainstream may ignore or focus on stories which they shouldn't. Help me out, Bill. Say this more eloquently than I have.
I think that's, you know, this, you know, sort of selection bias.
That's it. Selection bias. Two words, Bill. Two words, and you have summed up the 5 minutes of stammering.
I thought you were making perfect sense. I think you're not inarticulate.
Look, frankly.
But there's always going to be selection bias. I think that's probably, you know, impossible to ferret out. And so the best thing you can do, I think, if you're coming from an ideological perspective is, okay, where am I seeing a bias in the traditional media reporting? What stories are they missing? Where can I fill the gap? And so on the left, you've always seen, you know, a big emphasis on poverty reporting, for example, because that tends to be overlooked in a lot of traditional, you know, media publications. Let's make sure this story doesn't get lost. We'll still report. You know, it's not going to just be, just a screed. But let's cover some areas that are being missed. And so I don't know if conservatives have got around at the table and said, okay, what stories are out there that we think are important that the New York Times and the Washington Post don't do, and we're going to do them. I don't know if that's a typical Daily Caller meeting to have.
I mean,
where can we go that other folks aren't going?
I can tell you that one of the things that we strive to do, and you have to remind people of this all the time, including myself, is rather than just letting someone else decide what the story of the day is and then latching onto that and adding to it, sometimes you need to drive what you're going to talk about. So your headline or your top story should not be based on, well, I woke up this morning and Morning Joe was talking about this and the Washington Post and the New York Times were talking about this, so therefore we must also.
That's basically the model of almost all cable TV and talk radio. You know, those folks generally do not. Their business model is not investigation.
Right. They ride the wave.
Their business model is reaction
what are people
to
talking
what's
about?
Being talked about.
Yep. Exactly. And I think that's a trap. But look, it's fine to do that, and sometimes you can advance a story too, right? But there's also a time to try to be a trendsetter. And I think if all you do is try to talk about what other people think are important, then you're not driving the debate. I think Drudge is someone who obviously does drive the debate sometimes.
I would say less and less these days. Should we leave it on that note, sir?
I think that's a good note to leave it on. That's a good show today. Interesting.
Always good to talk to you. You have good Thanksgiving plans in store?
I think it's going to be mellow. This is the first year, of course, the first Thanksgiving where we'll have my little son, Burke, celebrating with us. So I think we'll keep it pretty mellow this year. How about you all?
A little bit of family coming up from New York State. I'll be getting my local organic turkey from my co-op, which I will then give to my Tea Party mother-in-law to put stuffing in.
Well, I think we eat organic, too, so we'll be doing that. But I will make sure to say a lot of politically incorrect things over Thanksgiving dinner to make up for it.
Excellent.
All right, man.
Well, we'll talk after the holidays, then.
That's right.
So always good to talk to you, and we'll catch you next week, I think.
Next week.
The holiday, maybe the holiday we won't, but in some future week on the Weekend Blog.
See ya.